Okay, hope everybody's well. And it's really a pleasure to welcome everybody to the kickoff of what we expect to be a fascinating series on great medieval thinkers. And it's a pleasure that Dr. Lasker is in from Israel and Boston via Boston. He keeps spending the year in Boston, has agreed to join us. And of course, this is also the post-Yuntif kickoff of a really slew of upcoming programming that I hope you'll all take advantage of. And we'll see you at many more programs. I'm going to introduce Marty Lefshin to introduce our speaker. Dr. Lefshin really is responsible in a sense, and it's a pleasure to have him here. Thank you.
It's a pleasure being here, and I'm delighted that Rabbi Kelman decided to put together a lecture series on medieval Jewish thinkers. I know that, from when I teach in the university about medieval things, I know that it isn't always the most popular subject, but I think that with speakers like Professor Lasker here, we will try to convince people that medieval Jewish studies really is an extremely interesting and important area. I also study and write about medieval Jewish thinkers, and I've always been just amazed at people like Yehuda Levi, that you'll hear much more about tonight from Professor Lasker, at the multifaceted nature of their accomplishments in poetry, in philosophy, and practicing a little bit of medicine on the side, because you have to make a living. And that kind of, we often refer to people like this as a Renaissance man, as a person who's able to accomplish things in many different areas, but I think that there are many people from medieval times who were able to accomplish many different things. Our speaker tonight is Professor Daniel Lasker, who is the Norbert Blechner Professor of Jewish Values at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev. He did not come all the way from Beersheba to us this evening. This year he's on sabbatical, and he's spending the year where he is serving as the Corcoran Visiting Chair in Christian-Jewish Relations at Boston College. As many of you know, Boston College is a Catholic university, that, like many Catholic universities, is interested in some form of dialogue with Jews. Professor Lasker is, I was going to say a medieval man, but it's a Renaissance man who has many different areas of expertise. His scholarly career began with writing about Jewish Christian polemics, but he has branched out into many impressive areas. The range of areas that he covers in his scholarship, the quantity and quality of his scholarship is truly amazing. He has 175 books and articles that he has published about Karaism, about Judaism, and modern medicine, and philosophy, and theology, and some really very interesting, at least I find them interesting, studies about the Jewish calendar. And every once in a while, when I make detailed comments to my wife about the details of the Jewish calendar, she said, "Why are you so interested in all these tiny details?" And I say, "Professor Danny Lasker is more interested, and he knows more than I do." And I've learned many things from Professor Lasker in all of these fields, and I'm delighted that we were able to get him here to Toronto, and looking forward to this evening's lecture.
Hi, good evening. I want to thank Rabbi Kelman for inviting me back again. I've talked here a number of times at Torah in Motion. I hope that he will invite me in the future, and especially if you invite me in the two sessions from now and give me the opportunity to present Professor Lefshin to the who will be giving one of these lectures. So, okay. Thank you. Middle Ages. I hadn't intended to make a defense of the Middle Ages, but given the bad reputation it has and the fact that it's used constantly as an insult, sort of encourages me to say a few nice things about the Middle Ages, not only about one person who lives in the Middle Ages, Rabbi Yehuda Levi. I just think that one should keep in mind, if one looks at the dark ages in the Middle Ages, as it were, and compare what happened then with, let's say, the 20th century in world history, I think nothing that happened in the Middle Ages can compare in the violence and the meanness and the horror and the terror of the 20th century. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is that in the Middle Ages, it was true, they didn't really understand a whole lot. They thought they were living the modern age. But we now know they're living, of course, we know we live in the modern age, the postmodern age. I will admit, though, however, there is some place in Maimonides talks in The Guide of the Perplexed about the dark ages. So he's talking about what came before him. So everybody thinks the past is not prologue necessarily, but something to deny. In any event, the Middle Ages is just modern ages 600 years ago, and I think there's plenty to learn from it. I was, when I saw the title of the talk, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, I was pleased because I recently had a little disagreement with the editors of a volume to which I contributed an article. And in the article, the first time that Yehuda Halevi's name appears, I call him Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And I was informed by the editors he was not a rabbi. So I said, okay. I mean, he didn't go to rabbinical school. He didn't have a pulpit. He didn't, I don't know what else rabbis do today. He didn't teach in a day school. He wasn't a principal of the school. He probably didn't perform funerals. I don't know if he performed weddings. He wrote poems for weddings. But I said, you know, if you look at the medieval literature, if you look at letters written to him, people call him Rabbi, Rabbeinu Yehuda Halevi. So we had back and forth, and I think maybe they said, okay, you know, the first time around it's okay. But then they decided that in scholarly English, one doesn't use such titles, and no one in the whole book is going to be called Rabbi in the English part of the book. Instead of the Hebrew part, they do use Rabbi, but in English, no. So I'm waiting to see whether or not they use any other honorifics for other people. But from their point of view, he wasn't a rabbi. He can't be called a rabbi. Was he a rabbi? No, he wasn't a rabbi. Did his fellow people call him rabbi? Yes. Did rabbi in the Middle Ages mean someone of learning and someone of influence and someone of authority? I think yes. And therefore, certainly it's possible to call him Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. As mentioned, he made his living from medicine, also from business. Apparently, he was somewhat well off because he was involved in community affairs and also in the rescuing of captives. You know, it was a big business in the Middle Ages to kidnap people and then ask for ransoms. In fact, to this very day, it's a big business in certain places in the world. So the honoring of captives, the redeeming of captives, was a honorary profession and very important mitzvah, which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was involved. There's so much to say about him. There's so many different approaches to the life and the work of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. First of all, there's his poetry. He wrote both secular and religious poetry. Apparently, when he got older, he regretted some of the poetry he had written as a young man when he had concerns of the youth, wine, women, song. And when he was a little bit older, he thought that was inappropriate, but not when he was young. He wrote a number of poems about Zion, about Zion. Some of you may be familiar with on the keynote, the Lamentations on Tisha B'Av, the songs of Zion written by him. If you're not familiar with that, at least you're probably familiar with the song Zion, 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 Alo Tisha Li, and very, okay? This is his poem. He talked about that his heart was in the east, and he was the end of the west, of Ma'arav. In his day, they thought that Spain was the end of Ma'arav. The end of the west has moved westward. There's a congregation in California which calls itself Sof Ma'arav. When I was in Hawaii, they said, no, we have a congregation which is Sof Ma'arav. If you go west further enough, you'll get back to where we started. I could talk about his life. And a big question which is asked is, did he make it to Eretz Yisrael? According to the tradition, which is older, which is much later than his life. He was run over by an Arab horseman as he came to the gates of Jerusalem and prostrated himself and sang the song of Zion. This is probably not a true story, but then again, with so many traffic accidents in Israel, who knows, maybe it was. Traffic accidents. Last few years, there's a lot of the concentration on books about Dearden Alevi's poetry and what it tells us about his life. There was Hilla Halkin's biography, and for those of you who have not read it, please don't. excuse me?
Why?
Well, first of all, I think that someone who doesn't know Arabic shouldn't write about a book written in Arabic. Right? Second of all, if I went about Hillel Halkin's life and his former girlfriends and his personal problems, then I'd read the book. But if I want to find out about Dearden Alevi, I think I'd look for a different source. The problem is that it's very difficult to find sources, even though there are two very good books by Raymond Shinlin and Yosef Yahalom about the poetry and what we learn about his life from the poetry. What's interesting about those two books is they come to diametrically different conclusions. According to Shinlin, who teaches JTS in New York, the Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, Dearden Alevi's leaving for Israel, was a result of personal piety and had no messianic motif, had no desire to bring about redemption, was not part of what he thought would be a universal move to the land of Israel. If you read Yosef Yalom's book, he teaches at Hebrew University, one would find out that this was part of a redemptive plan, that he moved to Israel because of his belief in this would help bring the Messiah. So you have two diametrically opposed books about understanding his life, and based on the poetry, many of them use the same poems. The problem with the poems is they're not dated. We don't know when he wrote which poem and what exactly were the circumstances. We could talk about the Geniza fragments and what we learn about them from Halevi's life. The Geniza, as I assume most of you know, is a repository of writings which were found in a synagogue in Cairo, as if instead of a window up there, there was an opening to a large empty room, and people put Geniza. And instead of taking it, in this usual synagogue, you fill up a bag of the parsha sheets and take them off to the cemetery. But there, they would leave everything there, and among them were some autographed letters of Dearden Alevi, and were also letters to him and about him, about people in his immediate group. So there's many things we can learn from those letters about Dearden Alevi's life, and here we have a very wonderful book by Professors Moshe Gil and Ezra Fleischer, who reconstructed his life and his trip to Egypt and eventually his move to Israel. As I said, it's unclear if he made it. What we know is that in Shavuot of the year 1141, Dearden Alevi was on a boat in the port of Alexandria waiting for the wind to change and to take him to the land of Israel. In the summer of 1141, he already was no longer alive. So the likelihood is he did make it to Israel. The likelihood is that he died soon thereafter. As I said, being run over, we have no real information. And there are many other things we don't know. When he was born, some people think 1075. Some people think 1085, 1086, somewhere between 1075 and 1086. There's one tradition that he was born in Tudela, another tradition he was born in Toledo. They are very similar sounding, and right, Toledo and Tudela. And it does make it, it's an interesting question, is it in Tudela in Christian Spain or Toledo, which until 1085 was in Muslim Spain? He went back and forth between Christian and Muslim Spain. The conclusion is that he was born either in Tudela or Toledo or somewhere else. So all these are very interesting questions, and if I had the expertise in poetry, someone asked if I had a handout, I guess I could make a handout, PowerPoint, and talk about the poetry, but that's not what I do. I talk about the philosophy. And Judah Halevi wrote one book, which we can call a philosophical book or a theological book, which we all know as Kuzari, the Book of Kuzari, and which, at least according to one manuscript, was called the Book of Refutation and Proof on behalf of the despised religion. That this would be a defense of the despised religion, which of course is Judaism. Now, why was Judaism despised in the first half of the 12th century? First of all, it had three major competitors. The first was philosophy, the medieval, somewhat religious, somewhat secular philosophy, which was based on the teachings of Aristotle, the Greek philosopher. Second of all, there were other monotheistic religions, Christianity and Islam. And third was the internal Jewish challenge, the Karaites, which I talked about once in Torah Moshe. I won't repeat that now. But the other monotheistic religions, which I mentioned, Christianity and Islam, were at war in the Iberian Peninsula, what used to be called the Reconquista, until it was decided that that's politically incorrect to use that term. All right, so we have the Reconquista in Spain. We have the Crusade in the land of Israel. Christians and Muslims are fighting each other to see who's the strongest and who's not involved because they're weak. The Jews. So both the Christians and the Muslims use Jewish weakness as a proof that Judaism is not the true religion. So Judaism, or Rabbinic Judaism of Judah Halevi, is challenged intellectually by philosophers and the other religions. It's challenged numerically by the other religions. It's despised for being weak. And there's a great amount of lack of Jewish self-confidence because of the situation. And this was the point of the Book of Kuzari, to defend the despised religion by coming up with a defense of the truth of Judaism. And that defense is based upon a true story, the conversion of the Khazars. Who are the Khazars, the Kuzarim? Where are they? Anybody know where they hung out?
Southern Russia.
Southern Russia.
Southern Russia.
Okay. Southeast, we'd call it probably Central Asia, because who knows where Russia's going to be, the borders are going to be tomorrow. But Central Asia, between the Caspian and the Dead Sea, this was a people who converted to Judaism. And according to the letter sent by one of their kings, the conversion was a result of a dream which the king had, and a discussion, or he brought a Jewish and Christian and Muslim representative and was convinced by the Jewish one. I said this is a true story, the conversion of the Khazars, but the book, the Kuzari, is fictional. Just to give an example, the setting of the story, when it occurred, was the 8th century, around 740, the Common Era. And the philosopher who's presenting the book presents a type of Aristotelian philosophy which wasn't existent in 740. It was something only developed later. So it's obvious that the author just used the story in order to, as the framework of his defense of Judaism. And what happens in the story? The king of the Khazar starts out with a dream, and the dream, an angel, what appears to an angel, comes to him and says, come on, something must help. Your actions are, your intentions are honorable, your intentions are good, but your actions are not good. So, what does the king do? He says, okay, I have to be even a better Khazarian. So he was, well, in Hebrew we call it now, mitchazek. He became stronger in his Khazarianness. Right? Anybody still gets the same dreams. Right? Good thing there are no psychiatrists then. Instead of becoming Jewish, he would have just paid a lot of money to a psychiatrist. Right? So he says, and again the angel says, your intentions are honorable, but your deeds are not. So the king decides he has to go looking for a new religion, as it were, or some, what deeds are the correct deeds. As I said, this is, the strange story is based on a letter written 200 years after the event, from the 10th century, to a very important Jewish leader, Chasdai Ibn Shaprut. Chasdai Ibn Shaprut was the head of Spanish Jewry in the 10th century. He was the minister, the foreign minister of Abdulrahman III, the Umayyad caliph of Spain, if that helps anybody. Years ago, I used to say he was the Henry Kissinger of his age. Some of you probably still remember Henry Kissinger, south of the border. But in any event, he had this letter which talked about this dream and each representative. There's another version of the story in a 13th century polemic where the king says to the Jew, choose Christianity or Islam or I'll kill you. He goes to a Muslim and says, choose Judaism or Christianity or I'll kill you. And he goes to a Christian and he says, choose Islam or Judaism or I'll kill you. So he goes to the Jew says, kill me. So the king says, no, I really mean it, I'm going to kill you. And the Jew says, no, I really mean it, kill me. So they take him out to be executed, and he says, no, really? He says, now choose one. And he says, no, I'm not, kill me. So the king lets him go. He takes the Christian says, kill me. He takes him out to be executed, and the Christian says, wait a minute, I'll be Jewish. And then he takes the Muslim out, and the same story, and he says, I'll be Jewish. And the king decides that obviously the Jew has the correct religion, because only he is really, really, really willing to die for his religion. It's interesting, this is told in Ashkenaz, in Germany, in the 13th century, where Kiddush Hashem is so important in the consciousness of Ashkenazic Jewry. In any event, the king is looking for a new religion. Where does he look? If you're looking for a new religion, what do? You Google, right? New religions? Okay? Well, as you know, Google, if you want to be at the top of the list, you pay Mr. Google for the privilege of being at the top, right? So on Google, there's a big ad for philosophy, there's a big ad for Christianity, big ad for Islam, and then on page 25, if you've gone through all the pages and seen, well, this is like this, whatever, you finally see one, oh, by the way, there's also something called Judaism. So the king says, all right, we don't go for the people on page 25, we go for the big guys. So he invites the philosopher. And what does the philosopher tell him? The philosopher says, you know what? God doesn't know who you are. God doesn't care who you are. There's no such thing as divine will. There's no such thing as creation. There's no individual immortality. If you really, 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 really work hard and become intellectual person, you might join up with the souls of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates, but you won't. It won't be you. And besides, he says, you know what? Choose a religion you like. You want one of the religions that exist? Choose them. You want a new religion? Make a new religion. So the king decides, since he's king, he doesn't need his tax-exempt status, so he doesn't need to form a new religion. But he's not satisfied with the philosopher's answer. He gets a dream every night which says, your intentions are honorable, your deeds are not honorable, and what does the philosopher tell him? Deeds don't count. So the king is unhappy. He doesn't refute philosophy, and the relation to philosophy will be a very serious part of the discussion in the Khuzari. We'll talk about it a little bit later. Then he calls a Christian, and the Christian says, I believe in the creation, I believe that God chose the people of Israel, gave them the Torah, and then in the last generation of Israel, the Messiah came, a human being who's both human and God, and sacrificed, he was crucified, etc. He gives a talk about Christianity. And the king says, doesn't make sense. And he says, you know what, if I grew up in it, maybe. But to hear this now, it's just not logical. And he even says, this will be important for later, he says, if I had grown up, or if I had been convinced, I'd try to justify it by use of logic, but I don't see any reason to do that. So he says, okay, goodbye. He calls the Muslim. He says, what do you believe? And he says, well, we believe in God who created heaven and earth. We believe in God who chose the people of Israel. We believe in God who sent Muhammad as the last and greatest prophet. And what is the proof of the truth of Islam? The fact that we have this holy book called the Quran, which is not imitatable. You can't imitate the Quran. The Quran is so beautiful, it could not be a human book, because no human could write such a wonderful book. And the king looks at the book and says, Greek to me. I don't read this book. I don't understand this book. What? How am I supposed to know that this is not possible to imitate? So he says, well, you know what? I'm stuck. I call the philosopher, no good. I call the Christian, no good. I call the Muslim, no good. The Christians and Muslims both say that the Jews were the chosen people at one time. Maybe I'll call the Jews. So he calls the person called a Chaver, and he says, well, tell me what you believe. And he says, I believe in the God who took us out of the land of Egypt, who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who gave us the Torah and brought us the land of Israel. So the king says, wait, that's not how a religionist speaks. A religionist starts out with the God who created heaven and earth, etc. See, the king picks up very quickly. He became an expert in comparative religion after two short lessons with a Christian and a Muslim. So, the Chaver says, those are conventional man-made religions. That's normal religions. We have a divine religion. And what's important in our divine religion is the experience. He gives an example. He says, let's say people came from India. They love using the example of India. Let's say someone came from India and said, we have a wonderful king in India. Everything works fine. Trains run on time. People wait in line and when they want to get on the buses. They stop at red lights. They stop at crosswalks. I mean, you know, it's almost like Canada there. So he says, okay, and therefore you should worship this king. So I would say, why should I worship this king? I don't know anything about him. Maybe the people there just happen to be nice, and maybe it has nothing to do with his governance. But if the representative comes with gifts from the king of India, things which could be made only in India, because it says on the tag, made in India, right? All right? Which give healing to the sick and victory over the enemies, right? Would you then be obligated? So he says, yes. If this king did good things for me, I would be obligated to this king. So he said, well, that's the same thing with us. And therefore, the Ten Commandments says, I am Lord of God, who took us out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Because it's the taking out of Egypt which obligates the Jewish people to God. Not because he created heaven and earth, not because of any metaphysical reason, but because of history. Now, it's interesting that if we look at Avram Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Ibn Ezra, I see next session is about Ibn Ezra. I don't know if it's Avram Ibn Ezra, Moshe Ibn Ezra, Isaac Ibn Ezra. I mean, they're all Ibn Ezra. I assume it's probably Avram Ibn Ezra, who also wasn't a rabbi. All right? If you look at his commentary on Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, he says, Rabbi Judah Halevi asked me why the Ten Commandments starts with I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt and doesn't start with I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth. In other words, the same question which comes up in the Kuzari, Avraham Ibn Ezra said, Judah Halevi asked me this question. Now, according to tradition, Avraham Ibn Ezra was Judah Halevi's son-in-law. And the story comes that he found this guy in the marketplace, tattered clothes, Samuel looks like, whatever. And he started talking to him a little bit about Torah, and he discovered this person was a really knowledgeable person. He says, come to my house. And when he brings him to his house, the wife takes one look at him and says, not in my house, you know, I have a daughter here. And they say, no, he's an expert, and he becomes his son-in-law. There's another tradition, they're cousins. And now we think from these letters that perhaps he was his mechutin. There's no word in English for that. It's his son-in-law's father, right? That Abraham Ibn Ezra's son, Isaac, married Judah Halevi's daughter. Anyway, they have a close relationship, and Ibn Ezra says, Judah Halevi asks him, why do you start? I don't know what you guys are getting related to. So Ibn Ezra says, because there are two types of people. There are the overachievers, and there are the less overachievers. I mean, is that politically correct language? I mean, the old days would say smart people and dumb people, right? Okay. With smart people, you say, I'm Lord your God. And they say, I know what you're talking about. For the people who don't understand that, you have to then add, who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In other words, this historical proof of the existence of God, or this historical relationship between Israel and God, is a result, is a sort of a, what you have to do, a consolation prize for those who don't understand the existence of God on their own power. Does Judah Levi accept this explanation of Ibn Ezra and his Kuzari? No. He says exactly the opposite. The metaphysical proof for God, I am the Lord your God, is not a proof. You have to add who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So the lesson that we learn from the Torah is the existence of God and what God did is known through history. And history teaches us a number of different things, including the superiority of the Jewish people, the hierarchy of existence, some of the things we're about to say. Well, you might ask, how do we know the Torah is true? So what does Rabbi Yehuda Halevi say? He says, we know the Torah is true because there are 600,000 witnesses. And those witnesses saw that, and they handed it down from generation upon generation, and everybody accepted it. If you have even 10 people who make up a story, someone is going to leak the truth. Or as they say, 3 people can keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. So we have 600,000 reliable witnesses. We know the Torah is true. Is this a good argument?
Okay.
Yeah. A couple people say yes.
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 No.
No. Okay. Everybody else is abstaining? Okay. Why is it a good argument?
Because no other religion can claim that.
Excuse me?
No other religion can claim that. Christian can't claim that. Christian has a legend of a resurrection,
Okay. Or you can say the revelation, Christian revelation, before 12 disciples. Okay? And Islam also has a small number of people. Judaism has 600,000 witnesses. And of course, those 600,000 witnesses are adult males. We're not even counting the adult females and the children. Okay, why is this not a good argument?
You don't have any of their testimony.
Excuse me?
You don't have their testimony. You don't have their written documents. You don't have anything from them. You don't know, even if there were 600,000, you know anything about them.
Okay, how do we know there were 600,000? How do we know there are 600,000 people? It's written in the Torah, right? How do we know the Torah is accurate? Because there are 600,000 witnesses. How do we know that?
That's a circular argument.
Circular argument. A chassid and a misnagid are having an argument. And the chassid says, my Rebbe goes every day to talk to heaven, talk to the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the misnagid says, it's not possible. He says, no, my Rebbe goes to talk to the Kodesh Baruch Hu every day. So the misnagid says, how do you know he goes to the Kodesh Baruch Hu every day? So the chassid says, because he told me. So the chassid said, the misnagid said, well, maybe he's lying. So the chassid said, lying? The Kodesh Baruch Hu would talk every day to a liar? So the internal proof of a truth is not necessarily a good proof. In fact, it's a very weak proof philosophically because we don't have any external validation of the stories told in the Torah. Now, I often, when I mention this, people often say, but it was also handed down orally.
Yeah.
Okay, what is our indication it was handed down orally?
What's that?
What's the indication that was handed down orally? But the Torah Shebaal Peh is different. It isn't another witness to the revelation. What the claim is that the people at Sinai, not only did they receive a written book, but they also told their children, told their children, told their children, until it came to us. And during this whole period, no one disagreed with what was written there. Okay?
However, even this so-called oral tradition seems to be based on what's written in the Torah. Well, how do we know what's written in the Torah is correct? Because there are 600,000 witnesses. And how do we know there are 600,000 witnesses? Because it's written in the Torah.
But it's not true, though. It was written after the fact that somebody would say it's fictitious. It's not based on oral history.
Okay. So I won't. First of all, remember, the fact that this argument is poor does not mean that what is being argued for is false. I'm not dealing with truth and falseness here. I'm talking about the status of this basic argument in the Sefer Kuzari, the Book of Kuzari, about the 600,000 witnesses. And what I'm claiming is that there's circularity in the argumentation, and I'm not sure that there's any way of solving this problem. In other words, that there is no way of external validation of the truth of the argument about the 600,000 witnesses. It's only circular or self-validating proposition. And in philosophy, we usually don't accept that. But
modern standards, though, right?
Excuse me?
By modern standards. By the standards of the time, it was acceptable.
Well, he certainly didn't convince everybody to be Jewish.
We've mixed philosophy and science today.
Well, I don't know if we mix them or
We integrate them,
but they integrated them much more in the Middle Ages. Science was different then, but let's put it this way. Whenever I criticize one of Gedolei Yisrael, one of the giants, he was a giant, and people say, how can you say that? I usually can then respond, well, Maimonides says it. So Maimonides doesn't specifically refer to this argument, but for Maimonides, the truth of the Torah has nothing to do with its divine origin, it has to do with its contents. Those are two different models of the divinity of the Torah, and I won't get into that here, but the important thing to keep in mind is not everyone, even the Middle Ages, accepted this as reliable, as a proof for the truth of Judaism. What is interesting is the fact that this argument exists to this very day, and it is repeated over and over and over again, and in certain circles. I even, in my teaching class, I have a publication which I would normally not admit to reading, which I normally do not read, called Sichat HaShavua, some of you may be familiar with it, in which this is a Chabad publication, in which they gave the exact same argument that you can't prove God through reason, but you can prove God through experience and through history. So the argument continues to this day. There are even variations. I'm trying to think of a good Canadian example. So if you'll excuse me for a minute, I'll try one from the United States. How do you know that George Washington existed?
Well, we have documentation.
You have documentation. Okay, you have documentation, you have historic history books that talk about Washington. Right. So why is it that you're willing to accept human documentation, these letters and history, and not willing to accept divine documentation, which is the Torah? The same argument with the same weakness. Because it's assuming the divinity of the Torah assumes its veracity is based on the divinity of the Torah, which itself is claimed by the Torah.
Christianity and Islam did say that the Jews were the chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
Did they? So don't they accept that God spoke to us at Sinai? They just say we've been superseded.
Correct, but that does not...
I know it's no proof, but you say nobody accepts it.
Okay, so what you're saying is when I said not everybody in the Middle Ages turned Jewish as a result of this argument, which was claimed to be good for the Middle Ages, what you're saying is yes, everybody accepted this argument, but it was superseded. But the argument includes the impossibility of supersession, or at least, let's say, if God wanted to abrogate the Torah and give a new law, he'd have to do it at least in the same manner which he did the first one. In other words, you don't have a public announcement of a new law which people accept, and then come 1,000 years later and say to 2 or 3 people, go out and tell people to forget it. You'd have to have the same sort of public announcement. Again, I'm not dealing with what's the truth of the situation or not, or falseness. I'm talking about the strength of the argument. So let me go on. few more things. Assuming that the Torah is true, and assuming on the basis of the 600,000 witnesses, the question arises as to what the Torah teaches us about Judaism, about the world, about Israel. For one thing, is there's a hierarchy of existence, with starting with the mineral, vegetable, animal, humans, and then one up is the prophet. The prophet is the top of the hierarchy. Why is that? Because Adam was born perfect, and his perfection passed on to his descendants. In Arabic, the word is safwa. In Hebrew, we usually use the word segula. There's a special quality that was Adam, and then went from Abel, but not to Cain. When Abel was killed, then to Seth, and then Seth had a child, and each one until we get to Noah, and then from to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And to a certain extent, it's a recessive quality, it's a recessive gene of this special quality. Until what happens with Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, they all have it, and from then on, all Jews have it. So this makes Jews special in the hierarchy of the world, and it's this specialness, this segula, which allows someone to join up with what he calls in Arabic, Amar Elahi, in Hebrew, Inyan Elohi, in English, the divine thing, the divine order, which allows for prophecy. So only Jews, only born Jews can be prophets, because only they have the special qualities, inborn quality. Furthermore, according to Judah Levi, Israel among the nations is like a heart in the body. The heart could be diseased, the heart could be weak, but still the heart is the center of existence. The Jewish commandments are the ones that God wants. So for instance, the sacrifices. The sacrifices reflect the harmony in the cosmos, in the world, and contribute to the harmony. Look at Maimonides, who talks about sacrifices as a concession to the weakness of the Jews, the Israelites who came out of Egypt. Judah Levi says, no, sacrifices are the heart of divine worship. Jewish promises are more reliable, such as the world to come. Hebrew is the best language. Eretz Israel is the best country. And he proves this a climatological theory that Israel is in the middle of the world. So the farther north you get, the farther south you get, the worse it is, and Israel is exactly the right place. I talked this afternoon in New York about ethnocentrism or privileging Jews, and I said that that most people think that their people are the best people and their country is the best people, is the best country. Then I asked whether or not Canadians claim that their climate is the best climate. I wasn't sure that was correct. Maybe you'll correct me.
Only Toronto is the best climate.
Only Toronto, okay. Right. Toronto is the heart of Canada. It's the heart of, okay. I know. And when I was in upstate New York, the snow zone always was 20 miles, 30 kilometers north of wherever you were in upstate New York. It was always 20 miles north of there, where it really snowed. Okay. When the king says, you know, what are you talking about, this Eretz Yisrael? I see these Yordim all over the place in Chazaria, driving taxis and whatever they do, selling them all. I don't see they're any better than anybody else. So, you know, Levi says, well, you have to understand that it's like a vineyard. If you have a vineyard, it could be the perfect vineyard, the perfect place for growing wine, for growing grapes and wine. But if you don't take care of it, if you don't give the correct nutrients, enough sunlight and weed it, whatever, it's not going to succeed. So Eretz Israel now is in a situation where it's not being tended the way it should be. But when it becomes tended, then they will be again the center for prophecy and the place for joining up with the Shekhinah. Sort of resembles the man who a farmer who took a piece of land was full of rocks and weeds, and he worked very, very hard, made it into a beautiful farm. So he invites the local pastor to come and bless the farm and see the farm. And the pastor comes and says, you know what? God and you have made a wonderful farm here. And the farmer said, you know what? You should have seen it when God took care of it by himself. So this vineyard has to be treated. And how do we know that it's the center place of the world? Because other people you've been fighting over, which you said about Christianity and Islam, they both recognize the land of Israel as central to them. Why? This is the time of the Crusades. They're fighting over it. And people are willing to die for it. And he said, you know what? The Haver says, you know, you're right. We should be fighting over it also. In other words, we should have the same desire to get the land of Israel. So, according to Judah Levi, reliable tradition is a guarantee that all Jewish doctrines are true. You don't need philosophical proofs. Well, it's interesting. The king should really be discouraged by the Haver. He says to him, look, you want to be a convert? Okay, but you're not going to be equal. Right? We don't really want you. So the king, however, relying on another Jewish philosopher, Marx, I'm sure you've heard of him, I bet, Groucho. Right. What did he say? I don't want to be a member of any club that wants me.
You've never joined a club that would have him as a member.
Correct. So the king basically says, you don't want me? Fine, I'll join. So indeed, the end of the first book of the Khuzari, the king does convert, but he's never really equal to the Haver. He never says us. When he talks about Jews, he always says you. And there's certain indications that what he says in theory about the convert not being equal is borne out by the way the king discusses things in the rest of the book. I mentioned the other challenge, charism. I won't go into it. I've talked about it, as I said. Just the conclusion is, in a sense, that charism to rabbinic Judaism is like Aristotelianism to Judaism in general. It's the philosopher who tries to understand things on his or own reason rather than accepting tradition. And the same thing with Karaites. They use their reason without accepting tradition, and they make mistakes. When one relies upon oneself rather than upon tradition, one is led to error. And that leads us to the question of the relationship between faith and reason. Now, generally, if you talk to people who know a little about Judah Halevi, they'll say, oh, Judah Halevi was the anti-philosopher. Judah Halevi knocked Aristotle on the head. He showed how Judaism is true and philosophy is wrong. And indeed, he said that Aristotle, one of Aristotle's problems is that he thought the world was eternal because he didn't have reliable tradition. In fact, he presents it as saying, in essence, it could be Aristotle thought either the world was created or eternal. He didn't know which one. He didn't have reliable tradition. So he maybe, in a sense, flipped the coin, decided the world was eternal and tried to prove that. If he had reliable tradition, he would have tried to prove it was created. So Judaism is superior to philosophy and science in having correct tradition, but the rejection is not of reason. We don't reject reason as reason. We reject reason when it's doing it in the wrong way. Twice in the book of Khuzari, the Haver says there's nothing in Judaism which contradicts reason or the intellect, which means that if it looks like there's a contradiction, one has to come up with some kind of explanation. It's not sufficient to say it's true. One has to explain it. Why are Jews superior? Because of the special quality, the sapa, the segula. This is a scientific explanation of the so-called scientific explanation of superiority of the Jewish people. In fact, he even says, if you ask, well, wait, Terach was Abraham's father, and he wasn't such a great tzaddik, right? Terach was an idolater. So what does he say? He says sometimes it'll skip a generation. He says, just like we know that sometimes the grandson looks like the grandfather and doesn't look like the father. So Haran, Terach's father, had the special quality, the segula, and Abraham got it, so it skipped over Terach. So this is a biological model of the superiority of the Jewish people. The climate of Israel, I said, was exactly the right climate. There are intrinsic advantages of the Hebrew language. Now, I'd say in general, if we look at it and think back what he said to the Christian about there's no reason to try to prove it, it's really very fits in well into the medieval rationalism. Let me give you an example. According to Aristotle, if I want to move something, I have to touch it. Right? No movement without touching. I want to take my notes and pick them up. I have to touch them. I can't just look at them, make them move. If I have a pen, I want it to move, I have to move it or drop it or somehow touch it. Right? Makes sense. However, there's a thing, a rock, a stone, somewhat, which will cause metal to move without touching it. What's that called?
Magnet.
Okay, I put a magnet here, I put some nails here. Without touching it, the magnet will cause them to move. Now, one thing one could do is say, well, that's against the theory, and therefore the nails don't move. But our experience teaches us that it moves. So the same thing, we could say that the theory is that all people are created equal, that all of them are the same. But we know in experience that prophets are able to go 40 days and 40 nights without eating, can walk through fire without being hurt, can do great miracles. So there must be a difference. I have to need an explanation. How do I explain it? Through this biological explanation of the specialness of Jews. So empirical reasons lead us to accept the truth of a proposition. One has to find an explanation, and a rational explanation. Even if what fellow we would call today rational, it was what at least he thought was rational. So Judah Levi was not anti-reason as such, he was anti-Aristotelian. I won't go into all the details of what Aristotelian philosophy is. But one great example, he said many years before the French philosopher Pascal, that there's a difference between the God of Abraham and the God of Aristotle. The God of Aristotle you can come to through reason, through thinking. The God of Abraham you come through experience. That Abraham tasted God. Abraham felt God. And, he says, it's that God to which one is willing to give one's life. The God of Aristotle, if it makes sense, if it's not inconvenient to be worship that God, you worship it. It costs money, or it's not nice, or you're threatened with death. You don't worship. That's the difference between the intellectual approach and the experiential approach. So I would say that, in a sense, Judah Halevi is the non-Maimonides in so many different forms. Now, I know Maimonides is not one of the speakers in the schedule, but certainly there have been many programs you've had on Maimonides in the past. So if you remember what you learned about Maimonides, just think the opposite for Rabbi Judah Halevi. At the end of the book of Kuzari, the Chaver, the sage, the instructor of the king, goes to the king and says, look, I'm off to Israel. And the king says, Israel? You crazy? What are you going there? There's no visible Shekhinah. There's nothing there. And he says, no, there's no visible Shekhinah, but there is a special aura to the land of Israel. And the king said, wait, you're a person who loves freedom. You go to Eretz Israel, you got all these mitzvot. You got mitzvot, you got Shemitah, you have Yovel, you have, maybe not Yovel, you have Tamai and Maser and Truma and all those things. You have all these different people fighting with each other and different Ashkafas. You know, here it's a lot more convenient in Chazaria. And he says, no, that's not real freedom. Real freedom is putting myself under the obligation of the law. So then the king pulls out his last card and says, but you know what? You don't really have to go to Israel. God knows that you want to go to Israel. If your intentions are good, it doesn't really matter if you do it. How did the book start out? Your intentions are honorable, but your deeds are not. How does the book end? The king says, intentions are enough, you don't need the deeds. So what do we learn from this? Either Rabbi Judah Levi was a lousy teacher, his star pupil failed the final exam, or, Goyish Kup, that's one explanation, which I particularly like, even though my article on the subject, I did not use that in the as an example. That's very, the irony is so strong there about how it's all right for your intentions. In any event, the Chaver says, I'm leaving, and the king says, well, look, if you insist on leaving, I won't stop you. Gegezun to hate, he said in Chazarian. And the Chaver leaves Chazaria, just as Judah Halevi left Spain. Judah Halevi not only preached Aliyah, but he actually made Aliyah, and therefore the combination of his life story, his beautiful poetry, and a defense of Judaism ensured his place in Jewish history and Jewish consciousness. Thank you.
Yes, of course.
I think you touched on it. I think Professor Kellner was here once, or not here, but with Torah in Motion, talking about, and also in some of his books he talks about how Judah Halevi and Maimonides represent two different approaches to the question of who is a Jew. And Kellner happens to agree with Maimonides that it's a philosophy. Judaism is a philosophy. It's not something that, even though it's not it's not purely Aristotelian philosophy, it still is a philosophy. And as you know more than I do, probably, I'm sure, not probably, that Maimonides was not fully Aristotelian. He rejected many of Aristotle's positions, just the way that Aristotle rejected many of Plato's positions. So that's one question. Like, can we view Judaism as a philosophy?
Okay, I don't think that you can say Judaism is a philosophy as such. The question is there something intrinsically holy or different about Israel, the people of Israel, and also the land of Israel, or is it the content of Judaism which makes the difference? And if you read Professor Kellner's latest book, which is probably what he talked about, is the issues of mysticism, that you have this sort of mystical viewpoint of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, where there are certain items, entities which really exist, such as impurity, and such as even the purity of the Hebrew language. And according to my mind, he rejects all that. A good example is the Hebrew language. We talk of Hebrew as the Lashon Kodesh, as the holy language. According to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, why is Hebrew such a special language? What's special about Hebrew is the fact that the Torah was given in Hebrew. This is the Torah, this is the language that God and the angels and the first humans spoke. This is the divine language. That's why it's a holy language. Why does Maimonides say that Hebrew is a holy language? Anybody know? He must have said this, Professor Kellner. There are no, how should I say it in good, easy English, dirty words in Hebrew. There are no words in Hebrew which are specific to certain bodily functions which are tended to, which tend to attract words which are not nice. Okay? That is why Hebrew is the holy language. Now, when I tell my Israeli students that, they say, huh? I guess he didn't know very much Hebrew. But indeed, if you look at Professor Michael Schwartz's translation of the guide, he has a footnote which he says, already Solomon Munk, who was a great scholar in the 19th century, noted that Maimonides obviously ignored the following verses. It gives following verses in the Bible which have words for certain things, which presumably Maimonides says we don't have special words for them. If you look at Professor Kellner's earlier book, Maimonides on Judaism, the Jewish people, he there refers to an example which I gave, which I sort of worked out together with him. We were talking about it based on a previous article of mine about the difference between Judaism as hardware and software. That for Judah Halevi, a Jew is hardware, is by his physical being. And therefore, if you take a Jew and program him to be a non-Jew, he's still a Jew. If you take a non-Jew and program him to be a Jew, he's not fully Jewish. A proselyte is not fully Jewish. Whereas for Maimonides, if you take a Jew and program him to be a non-Jew, he's what's called a tinok shenishpa. He's a baby that was taken away from his parents when he was a child, and therefore it doesn't really count as a Jew. Whereas you take a convert is actually a Jew. So your question about whether Judaism is a philosophy, it's not a question of Judaism is a philosophy. The question is, what's the nature of the specialness of Judaism, and what's the status of many Jewish beliefs? And Maimonides gives it a rational tinge, and Judah Levi gives it what might be called more a mystical tinge.
But if you say that, you know, the Jews have a special soul, or segula, or whatever, and their language is superior, it sounds so much, I hate to say this here, like Nazi philosophy.
Yeah, chauvinistic.
Well,
it's stronger, because
it's already been pointed out.
The Aryans were special. Of course, the Germans were not Aryans. Indians are Aryans, so they got the whole race thing all mixed
okay.
up anyway.
But you are correct that if one reads some of this material in light of modern events and theories, it sounds like a racial theory. Now, it was never fully developed, and there are those people who say there's no biology here, it's a metaphysical difference, and that it's not really a physical property, etc. I don't think that's true. I think he's talking physical property. Can you call him a racist? I think it's anachronistic in terms of modern things and in terms of other racial theories. But there is a certain amount of discomfort that a modern reader might have when reading such passages in light of Jewish history, recent Jewish history. Let me just add that where I live, there are many people who read the book and feel no discomfort whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had that discussion briefly this afternoon when I mentioned about Eladio Yosef's recent remarks that the Gentile, he used the term Gentile, is meant to serve the Jew. And he was roundly criticized for that. You know, that again is, in today's world, very political to say.
Well, I mentioned the Parsha sheets, these things they hand out in the synagogues here. I don't think you have as many in Israel. Israel, you have as many as there.
What does he mean by that? What did?
Well, he means exactly what he's saying. He said, why do we not need judges in the world? Well, someone has to be the Shabbos Goy. Someone has to turn on the lights off and on in the shul. Someone has to figure out who won the baseball game. It's important to have people like that. But otherwise, I just mentioned these Parsha sheets many years ago when I was still new, I read one which indeed said, why do we have non-Jews? And they said it's like a storekeeper. When you walk in the store, he first puts out the lousy merchandise, so then when you see the good merchandise, you can tell the difference, and you'd be impressed by the good merchandise. The same thing with non-Jews in the world. You have to have some non-Jews in the world to appreciate how wonderful Israel is. Well, at that point, I stopped reading those sheets. I had figured out enough problems with blood pressure without having to increase it. And the fact of the matter is there are many Jews who take this view, who do have what we call ethnocentric, if you want to say racist, view about the superiority of Israel. Judah Halevi's view became very accepted through the Zohar and through Jewish mysticism. Hasidism teaches that there is a divine soul and an animal soul, a nefesh Elohit and nefesh Behemit. Jews have both of them, both a divine and animal soul, and non-Jews have only a animal soul. So if you ask, well, what about still, converts? How can a convert become Jewish if you have that view? So either you take Judah Levi's view, which he doesn't really become Jewish, or what's developed, the idea is that a convert is someone who on the production line got a Jewish soul captured in a non-Jewish body. So by conversion, what you do is you correct the mistake. And I don't know if one can say lahavdil, not lahavdil. It sounds very much like someone who claims to be transgender. A man's body, a woman's soul in a man's body, or the way around. But the fact is, you have such views in Judaism. And the fact is that these views are not considered strange or outlandish in certain segments of the population. The same segments of the population for whom the Kuzari is a very popular book and a model for belief.
Can I ask you a brief question about
the it's up to the Balabai.
One very brief question. What drew him to write about Yehuda Levy? Did he have been so? I haven't read the book yet. It's available at the New York Library. I plan to. But what was it? What was his purpose in writing this book?
Hillel
Hawkins in writing.
Well, if I understand correctly, they paid him.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me? He's a professional writer. Well, someone paid me to write about Judah Levi, I'll be happy to also. At least they're paying me a little bit to speak about him. There was a question, maybe just.
Okay. I keep it.
I was wondering, according to Rabbi Judah Levi, the ability for Nebuah biological gene that is inherent in Jews, how does he understand non-Jewish prophecy?
Okay. How can you have non-Jewish prophecy? Let me take it a step further. The only place you can have prophecies is in the land of Israel. So how do you explain the fact that Abraham was a prophet in Iraq, or Moses was a prophet in Egypt? Well, the fact that Abraham was a prophet in Iraq is explained by the fact that it's either in Eretz Israel or for Eretz Israel. In other words, to get into Eretz Israel, he had to get him there, so he had to prophesy outside Eretz Israel. If you ask about Moses, he prophesied in Sinai. As we all know, Sinai is part of Eretz Israel. I mean, just because it was given back in 1982, that's irrelevant. The real border is Nahar Mitzrayim. Okay. Which is probably not the Nile, but Wadi al-Arish. If you ask, what about Yechezkel? Well, he started prophesying the land of Israel then before he left, and Daniel, etc. Okay, but the question of non-Jewish prophecy. Well, the only apparently only bona fide prophet, non-Jewish prophet, was Bilam. If you look at Maimonides, he talks about levels of prophecy. He puts all the non-Jewish prophets on a sub-prophetic level, not a real prophetic level. But Judah Levi says he has a problem with Bilam. There's one place in which he says the person who prophesied through the will of God. So apparently he's willing to admit exceptions to the physical, biological model if he has no other choice. But other than that, I don't think that you would be able to find any other non-Jewish prophets. You say Malachi or Abadja or Gerim. I don't know if he's committed to that. Let me just add that the irony is, how did the king become Jewish? By having a dream. He saw an angel. Well, in essence, the king was a prophet. Right? So this is one of the ironies of the book, and perhaps it's explained by this is either a form of sub-prophecy or this is a way of getting into Judaism, but I don't think Judah-Levi would consider that as real prophecy, which can be only in the land of Israel, only Safwa for the Skulah, only when the temple is, and basically when sacrifices are being given. There has to be all kinds of conditions, just like the vineyard. So, but, you know, other people, I mean, just when I talk about Maimonides, how can Maimonides say that if it says this here? So you say, how could you know Levi say it if it says this? Well, you know, sometimes people pick and choose what they want to adduce, what sources they want to use, and they also, the sources they don't like, they interpret to agree with their what they believe in other theological issues.
Okay.